Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
Okay, welcome back. We are going to get into natural law, as I've told you. We kind of went through Madison's essay on property, and I know that the train wreck is going to be constant, folks. We have to actually back out of the news cycle. There's more and more people. You need to join more and more people that are dropping out of watching Fox News. I think everybody understands that all these news agencies are in the progressive tank. So anyway, let me kind of dive into what we usually talk about. This show is also sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org and RepublicReview.org. And this is the only show that provides you the academic-based evidence and the academic-based solutions to actually get the Constitution restored. So there's this thing that we've been, so since the founding of the Constitution, America has been moving forward. The people of the states have been electing their representatives, their governors and politicians and so forth. And unbeknownst to them, the devious politicians and bureaucrats have done a lot of things without our knowing, thinking that they can actually switch things, and they believe they've taken control. The problem is, and I can't stress this enough, for those who believe in the sovereign citizen movement, for those who believe that we're under military rule, for those who believe that, you know, all of these problems are insurmountable, I am here to tell you that everything the general government has done and is doing outside the framework of the Constitution, creating corporations, declaring martial law, all of these things are unconstitutional. There's nowhere, nowhere in the constitutional process or in our history that the state legislatures actually authorize via the Article 5 amendment, authorize the federal government or the general government to do the things that they have done and coerced the states into doing the same thing. It's kind of like, you know, some, you know, kiddie law that these kids have created these rules and that now everybody secretly is abiding by them. I mean, literally, that's what's really going on. There are all these kiddie laws that they believe are more powerful than the Constitution and the states. So, as you understand, that because they had no constitutional footing, they had no constitutional standing, even though what you perceive is going on in the states is not abiding by the Constitution, even that itself, there's no constitutional standing. We do elect our representatives. There have been perversions to our representation, no doubt. I mean, we're not living by American republicanism. We do have, because I've had these arguments with a constitutional professor, and many of the points he brings up is, well, you have to understand that we've kind of been doing the same thing, whether it is under the guise of this or whether it's under the guise that everybody believes this is all constitutional. The fact remains that the state legislatures, and everybody will agree that the state legislatures are the only ones with the power to reel in the general government. So what we want to do is we're going to dive into natural law at this point. And then what we're going to do is we're going to get into the scale of liberty, and we're going to kind of move forward in content so that we can give you things you can sink your teeth on. So I've talked about natural law before, but what I'm going to talk about today and possibly over the next day or two are details of natural law that we've never really covered before. We want to put this into perspective. There are lots of people that believe in this, not succession, but there's a cascading of documents that, you know, they build upon each other, that there is this legal link Now, it's been an evolution. This is what I'm trying to explain to people. But this really isn't an important part of the argument. But there's a lot of people that'll tell you that the Declaration of Independence is, you know, the law of the land. Well, it didn't really create any law. It was it was an assertion from the colonies that these colonies basically declared independence from Britain. That didn't create a law, but inside the Declaration of Independence is where we find within our documents the origins of natural law, that we were all created equal by our Creator, endowed with rights of inalienable rights, unalienable rights, whatever you want to call them, that we have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, just naming a few. And so moving forward, they evolved the society into a government with laws in the Articles of Confederation. They also moved forward with laws that evolved into the U.S. Constitution. And so in the U.S. Constitution, it kind of draws the line that says everything that was engagements and or debt prior to the founding of this Constitution, those things will be honored by the United States. But everything else, everything else was kind of carried forward as recognized, you know, previous law, previous document, but didn't necessarily change or create a superior law like the Declaration of Independence over the Constitution. Now, here's the thing. The Constitution was ratified without a Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights is really those inalienable protections from the general government for stealing away our rights of religious expression, our rights of speech, and so forth. And so I want to stress to you that what we are dealing with the Constitution, is a framework that was built upon the Magna Carta, the Glorious Revolution, and the English Bill of Rights. It was built upon the Declaration of Independence and also built upon the Articles of Confederation. There's a lot of organizations, and the John Birch Society is one of them, that talks about the Constitutional Convention being a runaway convention. Madison actually felt otherwise, and that's why in Federalist Papers, I believe it's 40, 41, 42, somewhere in there, where he actually starts defending what they did in the convention in adopting and actually using word for word, verbatim, within the Constitution, what they did with the Articles of Confederation. They didn't just throw the Articles of Confederation away. They incorporated it into a much cleaner document. And obviously, and I've said this time and time again, it became a cleaner document because it was by the hand of divine providence that these men were inspired in creating this Constitution to preserve liberty and actually to establish liberty for the first time to proclaim to all the inhabitants of the earth. So what I'm going to do is I've got a couple of academic lead-ins from a few other people, and then I've got my own words to kind of throw into this mix regarding natural law. And then what I want to do is actually kind of give you this summation of natural law regarding the Constitution and society, because it envelops society if you understand natural law. And so this first one is natural law, the Constitution, and the theory and practice of judicial review. And these are long articles, so I'm not going to read these articles. I'm just going to give you the precursor, kind of the introductions, or you know how they kind of lay this foundation. And this is by Robert P. George, and starts off with, "The concept of natural law is central to the Western tradition of thought about morality and politics and law. Although the Western tradition is not united around a single theoretical account of natural law, it is its principal architects and leading spokesmen from Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas to Abraham Lincoln and Martin Luther King have shared a fundamental belief that humanly created positive law is moral good or bad, just or unjust, depending on its conformity to the standards of natural law. In other words, morality or moral law. This is no mere creation. The natural law is thus a higher law, albeit a law that is in principle accessible to human reason and not dependent on, though entirely compatible with, the indeed illuminated by divine revelation. St. Paul, for example, refers to law written on the heart, which informs the conscience of even the Gentiles who do not have the revealed law of Moses to guide them. Many centuries later, Thomas Jefferson appeals to the laws of nature and of nature's God in justifying the American Revolution. Most modern commentators agree that the American founders were firm believers in natural law and sought to craft a constitution that would conform to its requirements as they understood them and embody its principles for the design of just political order. Now, I'm going to take a quick pause here because we're going to go into a break. But here's the important thing. If you look at the Constitution, because it was an enumerated Constitution, it only delegated very specific powers, and all powers not delegated were reserved to the states and the people appropriately. And we say this constantly, time and time again. So here's the point. So even though the federal government didn't have, you know, or didn't have this ability to go outside these enumerated powers, the state still did not have a Bill of Rights applied to them. So anyway, we'll get back into natural law as soon as we come back from these two promos. Thank you so much.
Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our Republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on reclaimingtherepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Okay, so the number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK or 215-867-8255. Do not forget my three C's when you dial in. And let's get on with the dialogue.
Okay, so we were just wrapping up on the natural law, the Constitution, and the theory of practice of judicial review. And this is kind of like the introduction by Mr. George. And so let me finish this up before we move into the next article. But I want to add something. But let me, since you're all focused on this, let's finish this. The framers of the Constitution sought to create institutions and procedures that would afford respect and protection to those basic rights, i.e., or in other words, natural rights, that people possess, not as privileges or opportunities granted by the state, but as principles of natural law, which is the moral duty of the state to respect and protect. Throughout the 20th century, however, a lively debate has existed regarding the question whether the Constitution incorporates natural law in such a way as to make it a source of judicially enforceable, albeit unwritten, constitutional rights and other guarantees. Now, see, I don't believe that Robert George, gotta love it when people have two first names. And if you have two first names, I bet you have fun with that. But my point is that I don't think Mr. George understands that this is an enumerated constitution. The federal government cannot do, just like an enumerated power of attorney, they just can't assume powers for themselves. If it is not there, then the government, the federal government, has no authority to dictate. It's the same thing with the states. Are those powers delegated to the states? And to be clear, this is why we're going through this time and time again, because I need constitutional warriors. I need people to clearly understand this so that you can teach the truth. Let me just say this. Over the past weekend, I spent a few conversations dealing with people, great patriots, that kind of understand that the Constitution is enumerated and so forth, but they're caught up in the state of the Constitution or the state of the federal government as it is, and you know how we have to fight that. And I go, if you fight it based on their terms, then you've lost the war. You've lost the fight. And actually, this is a better way of putting it. If we fight Satan or the globalist progressives or whoever you see as the enemy here, if we fight the enemy on their terms, we will lose because they've given themselves advantages. And as long as we're working through their backyard, then they know where all the booby mines, the landmines, all these types of things that they can trip us up or subjugate us or make us go away. We got to stop engaging them. What we have to do is we have to engage the state legislators. We've got to wake them up. We must get them to do their job. And, you know, I know lots of great state legislators and they're trying their best to do this, but you know, then there's these other ones I know that I'm going, come on, folks. You know, you kind of wonder why some people puff up their chest and they want to brag about how constitutional they are while the entire Constitution is like sand slipping through their fingers. There is no stopping this unless the states do their job. I cannot emphasize this enough. If you want to save your state, we have to focus on the dark red states. I do believe there is hope for what I will say, Montana and some of these not so necessarily dark red states, but they could easily be red because the people that live there are really true blue, red-blooded Americans. They may be Democrats, and they may be completely oblivious, but if you show them, you know, like if you live in the Missouri state and you show them that the Constitution is being violated and you have the empirical, the irrefutable argument, the irrefutable evidence of what we need to do, then, my friends, it really becomes very, very simple. We're marching forward in going after the federal government. And it's a matter of getting 13 states to be the firewall. Once we have 13 states, that becomes the firewall so that if the federal government and the progressive states wanted, you know, jump into drastic measures, they can't because the 13 states can stand up and go, excuse me, you do realize you need 38 states to make any significant changes to the Constitution or to grant yourself powers or to be able to do these things that you're proposing to do. And in so doing, we actually wake the rest of the states up. And I honestly, I think once we hit 13, the 27 states will probably be a lot easier. Because why? Because you, the Americans, are waking up. And you, the Americans, and we're going to keep on saying, we have to purify our election system. We can no longer allow these communists to utilize these mail-in ballot systems and these algorithms and software. I've been telling you that as long as they have software, that means that there are algorithms and they can put in code things and or communications and backdoors and so forth to pervert the process. I tell you, there's very little process of perversion, or there's very little ability to for somebody to pervert the process. If you go down into a precinct and you vote on a piece of paper and it goes into the ballot box, everybody that votes there goes in that one ballot box. How these other ballot boxes even show up without even being counted? Are you kidding? And before that ballot box is packed up and taken up to the county, everything is, you know what, if we actually had a process and if somebody was found with ballot boxes without signatures and without all the other double checks and cross checks and everything else, that person goes to jail and they lose their right to vote for the rest of their life. You see, when you start actually putting consequences to behavior, people start changing. But right now, there's no consequences to behavior. So let me get on to this natural rights conversation with Mr. Watkins. And as he speaks, let's kind of look for, you know, how his perspective is, because I'm going to tell you, it's probably not much different. Anyway, the title of his article is The Natural Law Foundation of the Constitution. Our legal culture has lost the context in which the Constitution was written. I speak to the natural law, the idea of law as founded upon reason and logic and not merely the ipsy dixit, in other words, the dogmatic and unproven statement of a given power. This has had profound implications for the modern misinterpretation of the Constitution. Now, let's see if he's going to refer to the Constitution as a compact written form by the states. Let's see who he calls the founders. Does he call the founders men, or are they the states? So let's go on. To demonstrate this, let me give one clear example of the incompatibility of the modern positive law notions with the ideas of the founders. Okay, so it sounds like the founders to him are people. When the Constitution was drafted, it did not contain any Bill of Rights and had no explicit protection for the freedom of speech. To the legal positivist, without any explicit protection for the freedom of speech, the government could regulate speech, yet none of the founders actually believed this. Okay, he's dancing around it. Let's see here. When the idea of the Bill of Rights was proposed, the objection was that the Bill of Rights was unnecessary and that these rights were already protected. And he's pointing to, see Federalist number 84. Instead, any enumeration of rights already protected was seen as dangerous. If we say we have rights 1 to 100, that implies that we don't have rights 101 and so forth. So the enumeration of rights would limit the rights already protected. Not necessarily. This problem was eventually solved by James Madison by explicitly rejecting the idea that the rights already protected were limited by the enumeration of the Bill of Rights in the Ninth Amendment. Now, he misses it too. The only conclusion that can be drawn from this is that even before the Bill of Rights, the people believed they already had the right to freedom of speech. So, he doesn't understand. He didn't hit the mark where the Constitution is an enumerated powers. In other words, only the powers granted can the federal government. Is there any power within those granted powers of speech? No. Is there any implication that vernacular in speech and expression is somehow implied within the calling forth of the militia? No. If you look at the enumerated powers and the powers there's nothing about religion, speech, life, or anything. So why is it that people make this leap that, well, you know, the Constitution, you know, there's these general, there are no general powers, people. My face is blue. I am turning purple because it's just, it hurts me to see people that have these degrees and have these positions. I think the last guy, is it this guy here? I think it's this guy that's actually a part of the RAND Corporation or the RAND think tank or what have you. Anyway, let's move on. How can this be a positivist view of the Constitution? There's nothing explicit in the Constitution that mentions the freedom of speech, and yet it was originally widely understood that this right was already protected. Originalism disproves this strict textualism. Well, we're going to get back to this, and we're going to fly through the rest of these, and then we're going to get into some of mine, some GR's actual words. And actually what I'm going to do, because I talked about this in my book, we're going to cover my book, and then I'm going to try to sum this all up between today and our next episode tomorrow. But anyway, please stay tuned. We've got these two promos, and we'll be right back. Thank you so much.
If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me, AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and their 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath even though we're not required to take it because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's. And if you're ready to call in, the lines are open.
Okay, so anybody that has maybe some acute hearing, and I don't mean jewelry on your ear, but your ability to hear and differentiate between differences and nuances in sound, those of you probably have noticed that something's changed, and that's because we had a critical system failure, and actually it's not a system, it's really an application failure within Windows 10, and I am very livid. I'm looking forward to the day when I can get rid of all of my Windows systems because I'm just tired of the corporate spying and the burden I have to take on. But anyway, enough about my problems. Let's get back into natural law. And here's the concept, because as we look at the Constitution and how the framers clearly created a brilliant system of keeping the government out of everything that they weren't supposed to be involved in by simply enumerating the only things they could be involved in.
And so obviously these authors, when they're looking at natural law, they're not necessarily looking at it in context of the way the framers had created. But you've got to also understand that the Constitution hasn't been taught as they described it for well over 150 years. Anyway, moving on, and this again is Devin Watkins, and I believe he's of the Rand Group. Anyway, originalism disproves this strict textualism and instead requires a greater context to understand the original meaning of the constitutional text. See, this is how they're so generous and benevolent in helping us understand, right? Anyway, there are only two reasonable originalist arguments that would protect the freedom of speech without the First Amendment. The first interprets the meaning of the word law as used in the Constitution, but incorporates the common law of agency and contract to limit the proper scope of the delegated power. It's likely that both of these are valid and reinforce each other. These also require an understanding of the Lockean notions of rights and liberty and the just powers of government as commonly understood by the founding. My friends, they even talked during the ratification debates regarding religion, speech, anything, but they used religion in this particular case as an example. Can the general government create a law or do anything regarding religion? Absolutely not, because it is not an enumerated power. So anyway, I want to give you, and the reason we're going through natural law and its context to some of these academics is because when you go out and you read this stuff, you could actually get lost and get pulled into a paradigm that is not based on fact. Anyway, There are only two reasonable originalist arguments, and that's what we just read. And so the founders distinguished between law, which is the use of government power in the service of a rational, general public principle, and mere will, quote unquote, which was arbitrary political power. This distinction, of course, requires an understanding of the Lockean ideas of rights and liberty to determine what are the rational objectives that government is instituted to protect. Justice Samuel Chase, in the first big Supreme Court opinion, Calder v. Bull, in 1798, gave examples of arbitrary power, including one, quote, that takes property from A and gives it to B. He explains that an act of the legislature, for I cannot call it a law, contrary to the great first principle of the social compact, cannot be considered a rightful exercise of legislative authority. The obligation of a law in governments established on express compact and on republican principles must be determined by the nature of the power on which it was founded. And again, I can't emphasize enough that founding was on enumerated contract, or the Constitution was clearly enumerated. They had the power to declare war. They couldn't declare, you know, the necessity of baking or that people had to wear red hats. Moving on, he says, notice it is not only an express compact, the written Constitution, but also republican principles that underlie the legislature's rightful authority. Indeed, the founders just finished fighting a war because the government would not respect their fundamental rights. And that is absolutely correct as Englishmen, because it wasn't just that they had fundamental rights. They had fundamental rights as Englishmen. No other country had gone through what England had gone through, let me speak a little bit slower and a little more clear. From the Magna Carta moving forward, Englishmen were granted at some levels different rights and stations and were basically charged with responsibilities. This is when the militia was basically instituted under King John.
moving forward, when all of a sudden the king had forgotten that his powers were restricted. There was this thing called the Glorious Revolution. And that Glorious Revolution created the English Bill of Rights. And that became an indelible right to all Englishmen. And the American colonists were fit to be tied. They were upset, and they actually declared independence because the crown and parliament refused to treat them and grant them their rights as Englishmen. So, anyway, moving on, he says, the argument comes from the common law understanding of contract and agency law. Our Constitution is in many ways a contract between us, the people, and those we hire to run the government on our behalf. And where we delegate certain powers to our agents in government, but like any contract, not everything is spelled out explicitly. Instead, there are prohibitions. And actually, he's wrong. Things were actually spelled out because he's clueless to the ratification debates. He doesn't even reference how the ratification debates spelled everything out. Anyway, going on, he says, instead, there are prohibitions implied by the text, even if not explicitly stated. The government officers are also the people's agents hired to accomplish certain goals of protecting our rights, and they are obligated to faithfully attempt to accomplish those goals. No, they're obligated to comply to the Constitution and stay within the limited powers that have delegated within it. They don't have the right to be able to accomplish goals. It's the same thing as allowing, you know, welfare. Yeah, well, we're going to figure out how to do. No, it is not a delegated power. To purposefully violate those rights is like hiring a guard for a bank who then robs the bank, clearly beyond the scope or authority delegated, even if not explicitly stated. I'm telling you, my friends, it was explicitly stated. The reason that governments are instituted among men is to protect our natural rights, as the Declaration of Independence states. I will actually boil it down even better, because Madison said that there are two objects to government, to protecting life and to protecting property. When government gets to a position where they take your property and give it to somebody else, they're no longer protecting property. They're choosing who gets property and who doesn't, and that is not a principal object of government. That right of liberty is the right to do all those things which do not harm another's life. We have the right, for instance, to swing our arms around until that would interfere with another's equal right to do the same. Read in this way, the extent and meaning of the Bill of Rights becomes clear. Merely speaking or printing on your opinion doesn't cause harm or another person, but defamation was considered to cause harm. Private belief or exercise of religion doesn't cause harm. Mere possession of a firearm doesn't cause harm to another. The Fourth Amendment protects private property where it isn't used to conceal evidence of harm to another, in which case a warrant can be issued. The right to assistance of counsel was meant to overturn the common law prohibition on hiring counsel in non-treason felonies. This would clearly fall within the natural right of property and liberty to hire the counsel for your own choice with your own money. It wasn't until the 20th century that it was reinterpreted as a right to be provided counsel. See Bretz v. Brady, 1942, the Sixth Amendment not aimed to compel the states to provide counsel for defendant. Overruled by Gideon v. Wainwright in 1963. This becomes especially important in the recent Supreme Court cases, Lewis v. United States, where the government denied the natural right, but the court rejected the government's assertion and recognized the original right. The rights contained within the Bill of Rights recognize various natural rights, specifically those of a person's liberty to do those acts not harmful to another, it is within this context that the Ninth Amendment has to be read to protect those other natural rights which are not explicitly enumerated, but still protected by the Constitution. And I'll actually go a little bit further. If you read the Ninth Amendment, the Ninth Amendment is not some protection of, you know, rights not delegated. It is to protect us from delegated rights, not to actually construe our natural rights. I'll get into the Ninth Amendment as soon as we get back from the break, because obviously I'm going to just spill into the break if I keep talking. So we'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much.
Folks, Red State Talk Radio has brought back its monthly newsletter. I know everyone gets a lot of emails, but this is not a daily or weekly newsletter. It's a monthly newsletter. So you will not be overwhelmed with a plethora of emails from Red State Talk Radio. Come on, it's only once a month. I'll be contributing a constitutional perspective to one of the current issues to help everyone see an alternative perspective, or what I believe would be a framer's perspective regarding the issue, to help us maintain a constitutional paradigm. I will also provide information regarding a significant historical context to the time of year so that we can remember our history, so we will not be doomed to repeat the inevitable failings from forgetting our past and origins. Just go to Red State Talk Radio and sign up for the newsletter. This way you can get a focused view of what is going on in the Republic as well as what is going on at Red State Talk Radio. Thank you.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process.
Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255.
Okay, I got to give you a fair warning here. I've got a English bulldog that's a little bit fussy, and so she might actually interrupt us. And if so, I apologize. But let me get into natural law and my paradigm versus the other paradigms, because this gets actually more into what I would call the narrative of liberty and the historical context. It basically, during the Middle Ages, many historians attested to the fact that natural law was in tandem to God's law. At the end of the 18th century, secular progressives hijacked this natural law, dividing it from God's law into a doctrinal divide for giving credibility to socialism and communism. This is because natural law, as a derivative of God's law, was universally accepted, which again gave leverage to progressives to divorce the connection to God from committing murder, bearing false witness, etc., etc. In essence, the Platonists, or what that's what I call the communists or progressives, were setting up their own oppressive government that would have been married to their religion, which was secularism. They actually instituted a secular religion by the hands of the government. The end was to bring all back full circle, where the state controlled everything. This was the fundamental argument of the communists since Plato. Ultimately, and that's why I call it Platonism most of the time in my books and writings, because, you know, why give the label that Karl Marx gave when he basically just plagiarized Plato? Ultimately, again, controlling the means of production and consumption on the extreme end of controlling consumption is when the state will begin to control births. Consequently, our once enlightened society has dug up horrific practices of eugenics, abortion, infanticide, which is now done with the use of technology to terminate the birth of an unborn infant with the wrong gender. That's happening throughout the world. The penultimate end for the secular progressive is to transition all governments into a centralized state. The ultimate end is to unify all states into a single governing body of the world. This idea has been around a long time, and to substantiate the resurgence of the idea at the end of the 13th century and the beginning of the 14th century, one only needs to read Dante's De Monarchia. This work, along with other ancient texts such as Plato's Republic, has been the catalyst for the initial concept of the Illuminati, socialism, communism, and all these other forms of statism. Taking the Enlightenment era even further, as previously mentioned, the Magna Carta Charter was a significant catalyst for the Enlightenment era, which began around the 13th century. This is where King John had proclaimed specific liberties to the people and accepted the people's assertion that his will and laws were not arbitrary. But at that point in time, he still had a constitution, or actually this was a, you know, pre-constitution, but even moving forward in all of the England's history, like with King George when we declared independence, to be clear, the Parliament and the King had general powers. They did not have enumerated powers, and even George Nicholas points that out in the Virginia ratification debates. Anyway, later, the English developed this thing called the common law system, where precedence in ruling and jurisdiction was established. This governance by kings was the beginning of codifying liberties to the citizens. Now, codifying means basically putting into a systematic process, not necessarily writing it down. These were not absolute liberties, and eventually the people of England revolted in 1698, as I just said, and overthrew King James. This was the entrance of the Bill of Rights in England and a significant event in the evolution of Jefferson and the framers' interpretation of natural law. During the beginning of Enlightenment, scholars read and wrote about natural law, including the early founders of this philosophy, as I've listed before in my works, Thomas Aquinas, Francisco Suarez, Richard Hooker, Hobbes, Götterös, Pundendorf. I'm really bad with names, but I'm trying my best here. Locke, most people have heard of John Locke, Hutchinson, Barlaamaq, and Vattel, and even Bacon, Blackstone, and Montesquieu, just to name a few. Though they began to discover that Aristotle was wrong about all of his scientific laws, his philosophy that emphasized the distinction of nature from man's laws was, which was the law of nature, remained consistent where man's laws changed. This also applied to God's law and its consistencies. These pioneers of natural law argued that man possessed a much higher capacity, one that could discern and reason, a consciousness that could not be constrained on a physical plane and was capable of knowing good from evil, thus giving every man a freedom to choose right from wrong. Even societies and cultures that had disparate religious and philosophical ideologies were capable of determining good from evil, as it pertained in both culture and in God's laws that were biblically based, such as thou shalt not kill, thus giving man the moral freedom to choose when not subjected to austere oppression and or handicapped with mental abnormalities. Over time, these laws took social prominence, where men were awakening to the reality of their liberties being constrained or taken. In essence, these laws were constant and obviously the laws and or boundaries that God had provided as a framework of his gospel, an ideology that is in conflict with both natural and God's laws. Where is homosexuality? For illustration purposes, the following subsection will provide a good example, and I actually get into this. you have to understand that a part of natural law and or the law of nature is that when society starts to embrace a practice or an idea that is detrimental to society, in other words, it's good to have entertainment, and it is a good thing for a person to be able to, you know, take a vacation and decompress from their work. However, is it a good thing for somebody to be able to commit sin? Now, in God's law, God has laid out the Ten Commandments, and they were clearly defined, as I've talked about several times. They're clearly defined in the scriptures. Excuse me. And so understanding and using this example of homosexuality, it was clearly delineated in the Old Testament and even in the New Testament as a sin. And when one starts engaging in that, there are consequences to that sin. You can no longer, if you go down that path, then you can't have kids, because only heterosexuality will bear fruit of children. Now, there are people that have some physical limitations that we know because of science, but for the most part, there are consequences whenever somebody engages in sin. And what has happened to our society is we became secular. They wanted to encourage sin, but in an enlightened society, they tried to not necessarily oppress or suppress. They tried to put sin into its perspective, that it was a detriment because of the time that one spends. It's kind of like that concept of opportunity cost. When one wastes their time in doing idleness or something that has no benefit, then you have really, you know, lost your most valuable resource, which is time. Time is finite. You don't know how much time you have. More importantly, when society actually starts defending and protecting immorality and things that are debasing society, then society itself, the mores of society, have actually turned themselves upside down. And this is where society actually starts going in a downward spiral, because if you look, because society today is pursuing its own desires of feeling good, whatever we need, getting high, whatever makes you happy, go and do that. When we encourage that type of behavior, we're no longer leading in science. We're no longer leading in cleaning up our environment, cleaning our processes, doing things better. We find ourselves being sucked into a destructive nature. When you start violating these mores and these natural laws, then nature will catch up with you, because the consequences of violating natural law as a society, your society will actually decay and fall apart. This has been proven. Every society that has pursued the pursuit of self-gratification, the self feel good, do things, you know, eat, sleep, and drink, and be merry, you know, for tomorrow you die. Those types of mentalities and attitudes have been the precursor and the what led societies into their ultimate destruction. So natural law is those laws that actually gives us a guide rail and lanes in the road so that we can behave better. And actually, when you're following natural law, it is a progression of enlightenment. I'll get more into this. I knew I didn't have time to get all the way through this, so we'll wrap up this in our next episode. So we'll be back. God bless. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
I've been on the radio for a couple of years, and for over a decade, I have been providing content to help patriots understand what has to be done if we're going to save our Constitution and our Republic. Not one academic has been able to refute my argument for Republic Review, and even most conservative entertainers will not support Republic Review due to self-interest reasons. If you have not read my bullet point descriptions and executive summaries, you need to so that you can understand what we all need to do. I am trying to give patriots the necessary knowledge to take back our Constitution and Republic. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can read my bullet points and view the Republic Review flowchart. You can even order my executive summaries, books, and other content to understand the simplicity of what we have to do. This way, you will know what, why, and how to support the reclaiming of our Republic. Again, please take a look at my content on reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can become a part of the solution.